You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 25th of January 2015 on Monocle 24, the Monocle Weekly, in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to edition 290 of the Monocle Weekly in association with Persol here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up in today's programme, it's the first memoir written by an inmate incarcerated at Guantanamo Bay. We'll be joined by the book's editor from New York and its publisher here in the studio.
Then, writer Diana Nneka Atwona is here to discuss her award-winning new play, Liberian Girl, shown at London's Royal Court Theatre.
And later in the show, author and ex-diplomat Gerard Russell is here with his new book about the disappearing religions of the Middle East.
All that, plus our look ahead to the stories that are sure to set the news agenda during the week to come, here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Lots of laughs in store on this week's edition of the programme, Andrew.
I think we've got quite a serious lineup, but we can do that.
It's hefty. We can do intellectual heft, can't we?
No, I've got, yeah. Heft is good by me. had a good week?
Busy, as ever.
Well, where were you last weekend?
Well, okay. I had to get some. I felt a bit like I was one of those invalids who'd been sent to get mountain air for restorative purposes.
You and me were up in the mountains.
We were in Switzerland, up in a mountain. Yeah.
And
around 3,000 metres, I gather.
With Steve Bloomfield as well, was there?
Steve was there.
And what was the highlight, do you think?
Personally, I love a chairlift.
What about being attacked by the editor-in-chief in the middle of a street with a snowball?
I was not going to make official reference to that because I've got a police case pending. Yeah, you see, in my day, a snowball fight was an innocent thing. You'd throw the snowballs from range. It was a bit of innocent fun. It's turned into something altogether different in the few years since last I participated.
And my trouble was I was trying to throw such large snowballs, I could barely walk.
Yeah, it was rather easy to sort of telegraph your strategy. Because you'd just be standing there with a huge, like a snowman you'd broken in half to throw at someone.
We were there for a little bit of a conference, but we did manage to have a snowball fight. And the best shot, well, the most enjoyable to watch, was Steve Bloomfield throwing a snowball at me and hitting a large Turkish gentleman on the back. That went down well.
Exactly. That was one of the highlights for me as well.
My favourite line was when the gentleman said, "You, over here, I'm Turkish and I'm scary."
Yeah. And Steve Bloomfield looked scared. I think he hid behind some hoardings somewhere to try and cower away.
Anyway.
It all ended amicably, though, didn't it? Anyway, that's the most important thing.
And the conference went well too.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, what are we going to do next?
I think we should cast our eyes to the week ahead. How do you feel about that?
Let's get in a little kind of newsy person. Let's get in little Danny Giacopelli.
America's finest, Daniel Giacopelli, is here with us in Studio One.
Hello.
How are you this weekend, Danny?
I wasn't in the mountains, unfortunately.
But I bet you were getting up to all sorts of mischief, probably, were you?
Yeah, you could say that. Yes, definitely.
Oh. Well, that's very unrevealing what you were up to at the weekend.
Nothing much, to be honest, nothing much. I wish I was in the mountains, let's say.
Okay, okay.
We can work with that.
You can come next time. let's start the job you're meant to be doing. This is a news look ahead.
Yeah.
What's going to happen?
So today, you know, I like to start serious and then end quite absurdly. Today, Greece is holding snap elections, which we might be covering tomorrow morning on the Globalist. And also, it's the fourth anniversary of the Egyptian Revolution in 2011, if you could believe that.
That seems extraordinary. It seems like it was yesterday.
But yeah, 4 years today.
Well, we're going to be covering that topic a little bit later in the show when we're going to be looking at what's happened to many of the religions around the region. And I think there's going to be a bit of a spotlight in Egypt during that as well.
Yeah. So I have three things here, all that take place, besides what I just said, all take place in the U.S. Exactly a week from today, which kind of...
Oh, God. What are you paid for by the tourist board?
Our listeners are where they are. You know, exactly a week from today, which kind of slips into the week look ahead. It's the Super Bowl.
Andrew, you love this event, don't
What's
you?
What's that?
It's when you get American a really, footy. Really big bowl of cornflakes.
So this is an American sport called football.
So I know a little bit about gridiron, Danny. So who's facing off?
Tommy used to be a sports editor.
Who's
Seattle.
Who's grappling, Seahawks? With the, grappling with the pigskin? That's what people say.
The New England Patriots, actually.
Oh, go and, Pats. Okay.
And
that's my team.
Pats. Where did you read Pats from?
That's what they called it.
That's what they call it. Okay, and the Seattle Seahawks are facing off in Arizona.
What do you think about the debate?
Nothing.
Okay. a different topic, but the Redskins.
Oh, the name, you mean?
Yeah. Mm. See, I thought, first of all, I thought, ah. And then I actually think, ooh, I think maybe they should change their name.
Well, it is a messed up name, but, you know, so are many other things. Well, they should probably change it. I mean, let's be honest, they should change it. But a lot of people strongly agree to the contrary.
Especially maybe because it's in the state of government. I don't know, you know, it does broadcast a bit of a message. I thought that Andrew's going to ask you about the issue of concussion.
Why is that? Oh, well,
in
yeah.
In the NFL.
It is very interesting how...
They're paying out hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation because these guys are crashing into each other day after day.
Yeah, it seems the evidence suggests that it is a very bad sport for you to play if you want to have a healthy brain in the future. Which, I suppose they knew, but, you know, there's the evidence.
That's why I start with badminton.
You never got any shuttlecock injuries.
Oh! That took me by surprise.
What else do Americans like after American football?
Beer.
Beer.
True, but what else?
Bed.
Burgers and chips. Food, fine dining.
On the 25th, which is today, it's the Miss Universe pageant in Florida.
Why? You're painting a very bad stereotypical image of American males.
Football and beautiful women. That's what Americans like. Okay. It's hosted by Donald Trump.
Oh, gosh.
Last year, as of course you remember, Miss Venezuela won. And this year, the winner will be a Goodwill ambassador for the organization, complete with luxury apartment, scholarship, and $40,000 worth of prizes. What do you guys feel about pageants in general?
Oh,
there aren't many in the UK, are there?
I think they still
There's
persist.
There's still a couple of old-fashioned ones, but they're very, you know, they're sort of viewed as this sort of weird, anachronistic thing, whereas I sense with Donald and his cronies, probably they're still going to be front and centre on
that. Well, it's still seen as that in the US, but a certain segment of the population love it. A lot of mothers
What is that segment exactly, Danny?
Over-eager mothers who want their children to grow up to be
beauty
Barbie
queens.
Dolls on stage.
I like crafts. That's good.
What's the American one though? Is it the Westminster Dog Show? Is it that
yeah.
what it's called?
Yeah. Well, that's
pageants for animals are good.
Well, yeah. I enjoy those too.
Did you see this week, by the way? About I know we covered this on Monocle 24, the imminent arrival at JFK of the world's first terminal for pets.
Oh yeah,
the Ark. Have you seen this, Andrew?
No, I didn't. But yeah. After I left UNSS, we went to Milan for the we do a drinks thing there during the Milan menswear show. There was a gentleman, Italian, who works in New York, and he was there with the biggest English bulldog you've ever seen. This thing was like on the floor. Like
they
that.
All do that. Yeah.
I know. And
he'd flown in, is this right?
No, but he'd got a little red vest for it because he flies it on American planes as his emotional support animal. He even had a little passport for it, and he told me he'd had it made up as a fake. And he said no American airline had ever stopped him getting on the plane with, it was the biggest dog you've ever seen.
Does he have to book an individual seat for it then?
He
had a fake passport for the dog. He had someone make it up, and because he works in the fashion industry, he had someone make a vest for it.
He's going to get rumbled now.
You know what I read?
It's on the airwaves.
I read recently, and I've been telling people this, dogs hate coats. They hate coats. And the reason they're so placid when they wear them is because they're frightened and they're docile. It replicates the effect of another dog putting their nose on their back as if to say they're the dominant dog, and they hate it.
Dog psychologists say that
dogs hate coats.
I don't think you can say all dogs hate coats.
No.
Sometimes they
Do
wear
they go
the
to
coat,
heaven,
they
though?
Also have a little hat maybe on the well, side, no, yeah. that, smoke yeah. a pipe, something like that.
Actually, I've tried putting a coat on my dog. It goes mad. Does not
well,
like
a lot
it.
Of time they freeze up, but they freeze up because they think that a bigger dog is dominating them. That's why they freeze up sometimes when you try to put a coat on them.
Yeah, my mom said little trousers, okay. Coat, no.
Right. It has to do with the back. Well, there we are.
A scarf and a top hat, something like that.
Yeah. That's okay. That's pretty much, I have one more thing, but it doesn't really compete with.
I know. Come on, go on. Let's see. End on a low note. Why not?
It's the U.S. National Snow Sculpting Competition.
Oh, that's cool. I'm feeling kind of snowy because of my recent
pretty
alpine
freezing here.
Experiences. Andrew looks unmoved.
Well, it's on the 28th in Wisconsin, if you want to go.
So what do you have to sculpt exactly?
Anything elaborate else? Sculptures from a 6x6x10 foot block of snow.
6x6. Oh, so they're quite sizable.
Yeah, previous winning sculptures have included dragons, mythical fish, and children.
mythical fish
and children. I don't know if a mythical fish. I think that's what you say when you try to do a salmon and it turns out a bit wonky.
What exactly is that? It's always one of those mythical fish, you know, from the myths.
Well, it's like Chilean sea bass.
Don't bring all your American pronunciations in here.
What do you call that? It's
Chilean.
Yeah. How do you say it?
Chilean.
Chilean. That's incorrect.
Oh, we're not getting back into this again.
It's Chile.
Okay.
That's my news.
Is it tuna or tuna? Well, we're talking about fish.
Duke or Duke.
Danny, thank you very much for coming in to see us with your news. Look ahead.
Back in November of 2001, Mohamedou Ould Slahi was a 30-year-old electrical engineer living in Mauritania when he received an unexpected visit from two officials from the intelligence ministry. These days, in the murky decade-plus of America's war on terror, few stories beginning with such a visit end well, and Slahi's was no different. Having fought in Afghanistan back in the 90s, and with distant and tenuous family connections to militancy, his fate was sealed. In what he called his endless world tour, Slahi was rendered to Jordan, then to Afghanistan, then landed eventually within the small perimeter of the US prison camp at Guantanamo Bay.
There he experienced sleep deprivation, isolation, and severe temperature and sound extremes, a plan personally signed off by the then Defence Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld. Slahi remains in Guantanamo Bay to this day. His guilt, wherever the shifting charges, remain almost a foregone conclusion. Yet, in the summer of 2005, in his isolation cell, Slahi put his remarkable tale to paper, and the subsequent memoirs have finally been published.
The resulting book, Guantanamo Diary, is out now, and Andrew and I are delighted to say we're joined in the studio by Jamie Bing of Canongate, the publisher of the book here in the UK, and from our New York bureau, the writer and human rights advocate, Larry Seams, who edited the book. Welcome to you both. Great to have you with us on The Weekly. Jamie, if I can start with you, first of all, I guess the origins of this book and how it, you know, came to be published are sort of necessarily different from so many others, coming as it does. You think of the place where it's physically come from. What's the sort of publishing journey been like, from the first handwritten notes to this extraordinary reaction it's now getting around the world?
Well, it's been a very long one. Mohamedou wrote this book between kind of July and September 2005, and I think it was finally declassified, so released in the form he wrote it, albeit with over 2,500 redactions throughout the text, in, I think Larry can correct me here, but I think it was the spring of 2012, so almost 7 years later. And the first I ever heard about this was because of these extracts that Larry edited for the magazine Slate in the US, and that was, I think, was that 13 or was that 12, Larry? I think it was 12, wasn't it?
Spring of 13, I think.
Spring of 13. And then shortly after that, it was actually, as sometimes happens in these serendipitous ways in publishing, it was a great editor in New York called Jeff Chandler, who just acquired the US rights, who said, I've just acquired the rights to this really, really remarkable sounding book. I haven't read the whole thing yet because all I've read are the extracts in Slate and this guy Larry Seams' is brilliant proposal for what the book's going to be. And then, you know, I suppose we're now in the position where we are, couple of years later. Larry's done a just remarkable job editing this book, and what I wasn't prepared for when I first read the extracts in Slate and the proposal that Larry wrote is what an extraordinary piece of writing the whole book is, as well as the story being an extremely unusual and I think very important story in terms of what it says about what's been going on in the world for the last, you know, 10 plus 12 years. I think as a piece of writing, it doesn't surprise me that Le Carre was comparing him to Orwell and Kafka, or in this forthcoming New York Times review, he's been compared to Beckett and he's been compared to Dostoevsky. Kind of, this is a great writer and a very, very significant piece of literature, as well as being, I think, an incredible story.
Larry, I'd like to ask you, why do you feel that this story has, of course it's an important story, it's a tough story, it's a story of our times, but more than that, this story seems to have had incredible resonance because in his writing he seems to have more than anger, more than hate, more than kind of despising his situation, he has a kind of an understanding, a 360 degree understanding of where he sits and what he wants to happen and what he hopes will unfold. It's a story not just of kind of oddly of desperation, but also there's hope in that story as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it is remarkable to see how people are responding to the text. But I think, you know, when I first got the manuscript in the summer of 2012, and I had spent the previous 4 years going through declassified government documents that chronicled the program of rendition torture in U.S. detention facilities, you know, I had a good idea of the narrative of his mistreatment. I knew what we had done to him. But I knew that I was missing something really important. And when I read the manuscript, I realized how much I needed this voice to help me understand what this all means in human terms. And that's what Mohamedou manages to do. And, you know, he gives a portrait not only of what it feels like to be in his position and subject to this, as you say, you know, this incredible epic odyssey sort of through the global gulag of national security dungeon cells, but what it means for my fellow Americans, the servicemen and women and the intelligence interrogators, the men and women who we asked to go into those interrogation cells and do these quite awful things. And I think we've all known that there's something quite awful behind that curtain. And to some extent, we've allowed that curtain to remain closed, partly because we're afraid of what we'll see there. And the amazing thing about this book is that Mohamedou draws back the curtain, but he does it in a way that allows us to see that in the middle of all of this awfulness, there's real humanity, real generosity, and sometimes real tenderness and forgiveness.
Larry, could you explain to us the, you know, the quirk of, you know, law in the US that allows this man to be shut away and, you know, no, at the moment, no hope of being released, but yet he can write a great book that becomes declassified, that becomes a public sensation around the world?
Well, I think it's a quirk of law is a nice way of putting it. I think, you know, we're a deeply conflicted country right now. We're, in a sense, we're prisoners of our own fears in a way. And so we've come up with systems that don't make any sense, you know, in some sense, legally. And, you know, we've cabined them in secrecy so that we don't have to deal with those paradoxes. I mean, you look at the list of crimes that Mohamedou was subjected to, and we, you know, the interesting thing is the book focuses, you know, it's called Guantanamo Diary, and at the heart of it is this special interrogation that he was subjected to in Guantanamo, which is one of the two worst tortures on record in terms of Guantanamo. But his journey begins well before that. It takes him to, you know, on a CIA rendition flight to Jordan, where he's held and interrogated 8 months by the Jordanian government, and then to Bagram, and then to Afghanistan. And the list of crimes that are compiled along that journey is monumental. I mean, when he reported to the police station in Nouakchott in November of 2001, he was told that he would, you know, to drive his own car, that he would go home the next day. He got to the police station. They held him for 5 days. The U.S. had the Jordanians come and pick him up, send him to Jordan. He was held there. And then it shows up in Guantanamo in August of 2002. That entire time, his family thought he was still at the local prison in Nouakchott. And his family, quite poor. He's one of 12 siblings. His father died when he was a young teenager. His mother and older brother were bringing food and clothes to the local prison every day for a year. Now, that's called enforced disappearance. It's a, you know, one of the highest human rights crimes in the world. It's on a par with torture. It is torture because of the suffering that a family endures. So you have enforced disappearance, you have arbitrary detention, you have cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and you have torture. I mean, there's no quirk of the law about these things. These are absolutely and emphatically illegal.
I think one of the quirk of the laws, in a way, is you're referring to, is the fact that considering all of that, somehow considering what this manuscript has to say about what they've done to him, it got out of Guantanamo. Why didn't some guy in Guantanamo just shred it, you know? And I know that they knew it existed, but they lost in inverted commas, other evidence. As you said, there was like video and audio recordings of interviews that have been, or interrogations that have been lost in inverted commas. I can't believe someone didn't make this manuscript disappear, because it was the only one that existed. And if they had...
So is your feeling that someone on the inside wanted this tale to be told?
I think everyone, a little part of them, wants it to be told because they know it needs to be told.
I agree with that. I think, you know, I mean, it is peculiar because we not only have this manuscript, but we have this enormous trove of government documents formerly classified that, you know, include the detailed interrogation plans, the draft of the plans, that include the daily memoranda for the record of his interrogators chronicling what they do. And there is a kind of mania for record keeping among torturing regimes. It's just very strange. So in a sense, I suppose this document was part of that. Interestingly, the US government has released a couple of statements since the book came out. And yesterday, a Defense Department spokesman was asked if he had read the book, and he said, no, but I'm going to get a copy. I'm very interested. And he said, of course, we're quite interested in this. And he closed his quote by saying, it's part of our history, you know, which is an incredibly, an astonishing comment. But I think, you know, it was part of their, you know, the history of what they were doing and their record keeping. Whether or not they intended it ever to make to the public is another question, but none of those records were supposed to make it to the public. And it was only because the other records, the government's own investigative reports, had been released that they were no longer able to argue that this manuscript should be kept secret, because the information that it reveals was already in the public domain.
Larry, can I just ask you a bit more about talking about this manuscript and this extraordinary writer's voice? It must be interesting for you. I just wondered about the sort of editorial challenge, because you're known as a human rights advocate. This is an area of interest to you, and a lot of that is about giving voice to people who are voiceless or helping people to find a receptive audience. And in this case, I mean, what was that journey as you realized what it was you were working with? You know, had you ever before found such a lucid voice, such an incredibly engaging tone? I mean, I guess that's a different from your usual process.
Well, I had done a book many years ago that was a collection of letters from undocumented immigrants, you know, from Mexico and Central America to the United States. And there were occasional moments like it where you found in these chronicles of extreme realities that are part of a larger geopolitical question, these kind of amazing human voices, you know, humorous, engaging. But, you know, the interesting thing about Mohamedou's manuscript is there's two sides of me, the human rights advocate side and the writer side. And the human rights advocate side, I knew the broad outlines of his story. And, you know, the book is completely accurate in the story it tells. It's epic in the sense that this is an epic moment in the struggle for the American soul, I think. You know, all those things are there. But the things that really caught my eye when I finally got the manuscript were, you know, his voice as a writer. You know, he has a sense of humor, he has a sense of beauty, he has a sense of irony. He's, you know, deeply empathetic. He's got a tremendous ear for dialogue. And so, you know, my process of editing the book was learning to, you know, really appreciate the richness of his narrative voice, the often very sophisticated narrative approach, a way of starting a story and then moving back through examples to support his story and then back to the present. I mean, just those kinds of things were, you know, were incredible.
Can I ask you both a kind of a big brushstroke question, which is, you know, perhaps a little bit unfair, but we're, you know, 2 weeks after the killings in Paris, where we've seen this huge division even amongst the liberal left about how we respond to what's seen as terrorism, what's seen as extremism from Muslims. And I feel that it's like a strange moment where many liberal people, especially in France and Europe, have kind of sided on the right in a way. And do you think this book comes out at an interesting moment? Do you feel that there feels to be a real schism about to happen between how people respond to these events? And do you feel that they're, you know, of course you'll find the audience who are on the left who are supportive of these issues, but do you find there's a resistance amongst a more mainstream audience now who's thinking, do you know what, as we've, you know, we've seen the language coming out of France, it was the language coming out after September 11. It's, you know, we're at war, this is a battle, we need to do everything we can to defend our nation.
I was just going to kick off and say, for me, the timeliness of this publication could not be greater. And, you know, to the degree that I felt, you know, Je suis Charlie Hebdo, I feel absolutely as much Je suis Mohamedou Ould Slahi. And I would really put that to anyone and everyone. You know, to me, this is actually so important because it makes it clear that we're not living in some Manichaean world with this kind of ridiculous black and white duality. You're either with us or against us. All the bullshit rhetoric that came out with the war on terror, which actually is the most ultimately pernicious and perpetual.
And which allowed this to happen.
Yeah, and which allowed this to happen. So actually what you've got here is someone, despite what has been done to him, despite showing you that actually there's another way, there's an incredible love and compassion and forgiveness that's infusing this book. Kind of the importance of this book, I cannot stress enough in the times we're living in right now, particularly after what happened in Paris.
Larry, we should just bring you in on this question.
I agree completely. I mean, I think it's extraordinary how much, you know, this book and this voice is the voice for the moment. I think Mohamedou, in his approach to us, points the way forward. You know, at this point, after 13 years, he deserves this, the same fair hearing and the same fair judgment that he gives us in this book. I mean, look, you know, he has been in this position, the product of a terrible miscalculation and mistake about who he was, a mistake that was compounded by the brutal treatment that he was subjected to. It serves no purpose to perpetuate that mistake except to delay accountability for that mistake. That's what's been going on here for a long, long time. And, you know, it doesn't help the cause of peace and cross-cultural understanding and, you know, the tensions that are behind the Charlie Hebdo killing or our own fear or anything to continue to perpetuate those mistakes. I mean, I grew up with, you know, at a time when I learned early on that if you want peace, you work for justice. You know, justice, it grows from the ground up. You know, we have Mohamedou's case is a case of extreme misjustice, extreme injustice. And we have to, by addressing his case, if we can get his case right, then we can get the next case right, the next case right. We can close Guantanamo, and then we can move forward to a more just world writ large.
Larry Seams, the writer and human rights advocate and editor of the book Guantanamo Diary, and here in London, Jamie Bing of Canongate, the publisher here in the UK. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us on The Weekly. I think it's just about time to play some music. Let's have a bit of a change of pace, Andrew. What do you think about that? Good idea?
I think wise.
Wise indeed. Let's play this one. I think, you know, Andrew, I'm not sure if you've heard this, but I think you're going to like it. It's Phosphorescent. This is Song for Zula.
Well, that was Phosphorescent. Try spelling that with Song for Zula.
As Design Miami celebrated its 10th anniversary this year, Monocle Films explored new themes in the collectible design market.
I think that we're beginning to become more of a design-driven culture as we learn to consume more responsibly. We're beginning to learn that better design helps us actually live better. And I think America's finally waking up to that fact.
Pull up a chair to watch Design Miami 2014, now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
You're listening to The Weekly here on Monocle 24. Now, our next guest is Diana Nneka-Otwuona, the London-born author of the award-winning play Liberian Girl, showing now at the Royal Court Theatre here in London. The play focuses on a 14-year-old child soldier in Liberia's deadly civil war, in which 200,000 people were killed and a million others displaced.
A bit earlier, Diana spoke with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, about finding the inspiration to write and how to translate the trauma of the conflict onto the stage.
Well, I've always been interested in writing, creative writing, since I was a child, music, and, you know, I wrote plays for my church and things like that. But it wasn't until about 7 years ago that I actually decided to pursue this actively. There's so many other careers I tried and failed at.
Until like, I just, like what?
Well, I went to law school. I was going to become a barrister and dropped out. Got involved in local politics, and that didn't last very long. So writing was something I always wanted to do. It wasn't until, say, 7 years ago that I believed I actually could do it. And so then I've actively pursued it since.
And what sort of writing did you start with 7 years ago?
Really kind of stuff that kind of makes me cringe. Just things on my doorstep, you know, kind of things about my childhood, really kind of simple stuff. It was only when I actually teamed up with my brother that I became more serious and realised that actually I've always had a passion for social justice and politics and all those kind of things. And not that it's exclusively what I write, but I think writing is a really effective way of being part of the system without being part of the system, if that makes sense.
And playwriting for you, I read an interview you did recently where you said you felt that the idea of writing a play was quite restrictive and that you perhaps thought it wasn't for you. What were the things that turned you off writing plays to begin with?
Well, I think when you haven't grown up watching plays, that is a factor. I did watch plays at school, but it was really rare and it tends to be musicals, and so my experience of the stage was very limited. And it was only when I started to intern at the Royal Court Theatre that I watched plays, and but really different kinds of plays. They were really kind of innovative in the way that they produced them. It just kind of plays that I'd never seen before. So I think it's when I started to realise that, I actually know this is doable.
Because that's one of the things about the Royal Court as a theatre, and like so much new writing, is that it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to have a three-act structure. There don't have to be, exactly, you know, a certain number of characters, a stage, which is sort of in a traditional style.
Mm. Definitely. And I would say I'm very much influenced by film, because that's what I grew up watching. Yeah, so the movies, TV, that kind of stuff, I think does inform the way I write plays as well. Very much into the action and big big stories, so yeah.
And tell us a bit about then how you came to decide to write plays. So you'd been interning at the Royal Court, you were writing other things. What was the moment that made you think, right, I'm going to try writing for the stage?
Well, I had the opportunity to join one of their writing programs, so I took it. And it was while I was there that, you know, I got to meet more writers in various stages of their careers. And it was just from there, really.
And Liberian Girl, do people assume, because of your name and you're writing about Liberia, that, well, you must be Liberian?
Yeah, and I can't tell you how exhausting that is, because I can think of so many examples of where writers who have not been from that experience have written about something, but people seem to be really obsessed with having to have lived something for you in order to want to write it.
And yet not in the same way that, you know, if, say, I wrote a play about the US, people wouldn't assume that I were American. Do you think this is partly about the way that people view Africa, as in it's, you know, they don't differentiate between different countries. It's all just, it's Africa as a country.
Yeah, well, there's definitely something in that. But I do think, well, I guess also people have to find a way of understanding things, don't they? So to them, they think if someone writes a play about Liberia, it must be because they've had that experience, which is not necessarily the case.
You haven't had that experience of Liberia.
No.
Why did you choose Liberia? Was it the country or the story within that country that attracted you?
A bit of both, really. Actually, my brother and I were working on a screenplay called The Lone Star, which is, he came up with the idea. I developed it with him, but then I went off and I scripted it. And it was about these two boys who form an unlikely friendship during the Civil War. It was about football and a journey to the capital and all that good stuff. And nothing came of it. I had to abandon it. And it was actually when I started the writing program at the court that I remembered the story that we worked on. And by then I'd fallen in love with the country. I'd done so much research, and it wasn't just the war. It was also its history. I mean, Liberia, and I'm from Nigeria, but Liberia is so different from its West African neighbors. And I knew so little about it. And so I'd fallen in love with it. And so, yeah, I just really wanted to write something in it. And the child soldiers, but also the conflict being a particularly brutal one.
And you're right, it's got that very different history from anywhere else in West Africa, because it was a country that was essentially established by freed slaves from the US.
Exactly.
Who came over and basically like, right, well, this land is ours now.
Exactly.
And basically essentially sort of recolonised it.
Behaved like their own oppressors.
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
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 And it's had this, you know, very difficult and at times very violent and volatile history over the last 200 years. Mm. The period you chose to write about was when Charles Taylor was president.
No, where he was trying to gain.
Where he was trying to become president.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And Charles Taylor now languishing in jail, I think somewhere in England now.
Yeah,
in prison here. Something of a fall from grace. It tell us a bit about that period and what you think made it particularly dramatic.
I think it's because it was the early stages. Nobody really... What's really interesting about the onset of any war is that people don't want to believe that it's coming. And that was the period that I think also because there wasn't as many female child soldiers as there were towards the end of the war. So that pit for my story to really work, it really was better to put it in the early half, really. Any part of the timeline it could have worked, but I think it was especially effective at the beginning.
Okay, so you give us a bit of the context. Tell us what the play's about.
Our protagonist is a 14-year-old girl called Martha, and it's all about her the night before she's due to go off to the bush school. I don't know if you know about the bush school, but it's a kind of rite of passage for Liberian boys and girls. There's a male and female equivalent. But the day before she's due to go, the village is raided by rebels. So she's forced to flee with her grandmother. But because rape was such a massive feature of the war, the grandmother wants to protect her granddaughter by dressing her up as a boy, in order for them to gain safe passage out of the village. And they get to a checkpoint and it's manned by all these intoxicated child soldiers, and thinking that she's a boy, they forcibly recruit her to become a soldier. So, yeah, it's really about her experience as a girl, as a boy who's really a girl in a rebel army.
And when you were researching and writing and then, you know, developing this play, what were the things that you turned to for research? What were the stories you read or the people that you spoke to really gain an understanding, not just of the facts,
yeah,
but of the feel, the texture of what was going on there?
Well, you do all the basic stuff. I have to say, the internet is a fantastic resource for writers. I don't know what I'd be doing without the internet, but British Library, I bought loads of books. But also, I think my best resource was actually just talking to some survivors, which wasn't that easy, actually, because there's not a huge Liberian population in this country. I think they're more in the US. But I lucked out and I found this guy who was amazing. And he just gave you the kind of detail that you can't find online or even in the books. It's just that kind of stuff that can only really come from first-hand accounts.
Do you think, talking more broadly, there's pressure on younger or newer writers to write about what they know, and you tell your story or a version of your story, rather than, you know, what you've done here, which is to tell a completely different story that has nothing to do with you or your background?
Well, interestingly, I would say that actually, though Liberian girl, you know, the war is the backdrop that I haven't experienced, within that story are things that I have experienced. I do know what it's like to have friendship. I do know what it's the need to want to survive. I understand all those kind of things. So I think it's very rare that a writer completely writes what they don't know. Within a subject that you might not know is still going to be something that you know, and something that's within all of us as human beings, if that makes sense.
There's a debate in this country, in certain circles in this country at the moment, about diversity in the arts, whether that is the number of Oscar-nominated actors who went to Eton, or whether that's, you know, to do with, you know, the lack of black faces, not just on stage, but writing, directing, and so on. Is this one of those debates that you wish you just didn't have to ever get involved in, or do you feel quite passionate about the fact that, as someone who is now, you know, a playwright at the Royal Court, you've got a platform to say what you think should be done or shouldn't be done?
Yeah, no, I think I do have a responsibility. Having said that, I do think, actually, in many ways, every time a woman or a black person or a disabled person or whatever gets a play staged or gets a movie out or, you know, stars in the movie, you are in your own way part of the change, because it does make it that bit easier for other people to come through. But absolutely, yeah, there is a responsibility on us all, not even just creatives who are from BAME communities. Those who are, you know, a lot of the support that's come from this Act for Change movement has come from white creatives. It's not just people who are from the minority community. So yeah, we have a responsibility. But I just want to say, I think within the next 10 years, I really do believe that the landscape is going to be quite different. And it's going to be one of those changes that's kind of, either they diversify or they die. Do you know what I mean? It's just because change is inevitable. So either the major guys, they recognise it, or they're just going to be left behind, because it's coming. I really do believe it's coming, and I'd like to be a part of it.
Diana Neka Atwona, writer of the new play Liberian Girl, showing now at London's Royal Court, in conversation with Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield.
Up next, a portrait of the disappearing religions of the Middle East.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, now with newspaper headlines focusing ever more on the threat of Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. It's thrown the region's lesser-known faiths and the role they play in the area's politics into sharp focus.
Gerald Russell spent more than a dozen years as a diplomat in the Middle East for the United Kingdom and the United Nations. His first book, out now, paints a portrait of seven endangered religions that can trace their origins back to ancient Persia, Babylon, and Egypt.
It's called Heirs to Forgotten Kingdoms, Journeys into the Disappearing Religions of the Middle East. And Gerard joins us now in the studio at Inventory House. Gerard, thanks very much for being with us. Let me ask you first of all about some of these, the stories that you tell in the book, and the fact that it seems to follow on from, you know, empire. So much of the stories detail what followed, perhaps, you know, the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And then coming more up to date, there's stories you mentioned in the introduction there. Think of what's been happening recently with the Yazidis, people who were protected, you know, for example, in Iraq under the regime of Saddam Hussein. Is it very much a story that these things tend to unravel when great empires or tyrants leave the scene? Is this what happens in the vacuum that follows often?
I guess these religions have been facing persecution and crisis for centuries. The Middle East has been an unstable region for so much of modern history. And what we see now in Iraq in particular isn't just a renewal of that instability, but also a much greater polarization by religion, which is something that in the 20th century was not that common in the Arab world. We these days might think of it as obvious that, you know, in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, people are predominantly identifying by religion. But that's a relatively new thing. And if one looks back to between 1860 and 1930 in Egypt, for example, there were three Christian prime ministers. If you look at Iraq in the 1950s, you had members of this very ancient 1,800-year-old Babylonian religion, the Mandaeans, who were rising to prominence in academia. So there has been a century of progress, and most recently, it's really been mostly reversed.
And tell me, that reversal, is it to do with the fact that we're losing leaders, as Tom was saying, who may have been tyrants, but they were secular in nature, and this coming to forward of faith, in some instances, in a kind of extremist way, is changing the game for all of these religions?
Definitely the social tide is changing. It's difficult to sort of give the credit, if you like, for the survival of these religions to all the dictators of the Arab world, because before they existed, there were more liberal regimes, sometimes monarchies, and there were even sometimes popular revolutions in Iran, for example, in 1909, that gave a higher status to minorities than they had had before. There was a great wave of social progress in the Middle East, which has now partly been undone, but one can hope that it can one day resume. What I think is important when you're looking at Islam is to realize that, you know, Islamic State, fundamentalism, and so on, have only recently become quite strong in the Arab world, and we can hope that they will disappear as quickly as they've come.
Let me ask you a little bit about the way that, I guess, sort of different parts of identity shift. You know, borders in these regions often very porous, or they've shifted, like the sands that are often there. There's an interesting conflation, I guess, of religious identity and ethnic identity with notions of citizenship across, you know, Eastern Europe, throughout the Middle East, again, on a lot of the, throughout that sort of old Ottoman Empire, if you will. Is that a bit of a recurrent theme when you sort of work your way through a number of these different groups in the book, that those blurring lines quite interesting?
Well, they often live on the borderlands. The Yazidis, who famously were, you know, massacred by the Islamic State in August, have lived for centuries on the borderlands of what was the Ottoman Empire and the Persian Empire, the borders of Iraq and Syria. They've lived in Armenia and Georgia because those are the places that are most neglected and where you're least likely to come under pressure to convert. And being remote peasant farmers often, they had no incentive to really to convert. If you're a merchant in a city, you might well want to have the same religion as the people around you. But if you're living in a remote valley, it's less of a social pressure. And so the borderlands are tremendously important to these religions, as are mountains, marshes. The Mandaeans lived for 1,800 years in the marshes of Iraq, a place, by the way, that was the birthplace of three religions, not just the Mandaeans, but also the Manichaeans, who were once so famous, and St. Augustine, of course, almost became one back in the 4th century. So there was, for centuries, these remote places in the Middle East have been the birthplace of faiths that have then spread across the world.
Give us a portrait of a couple of the religions in the book. For example, you go and see the Druze now, luckily through Monocle. I've been to Lebanon a couple of times, and I've always been struck when you arrive there. Again, from the outside, you imagine it's going to be kind of probably a kind of, you know, Muslim and maybe some Christians. And when you get there, you realize what a patchwork of people it is, even amongst the Muslim communities. The Druze are kind of an interesting, unique group of people. Could you just explain to our listeners a little bit about them and how you came to visit them?
The Druze are would call themselves part of the family of Islam, but they're very different from Orthodox Muslims. So they believe in reincarnation. They have a great reverence for the Greek philosophers. They will refer to Plato as divine. There's a number of ways in which they really do differ from mainstream Islam. And what you'll see if you go to a Druze village, you'll see no sign of religiosity. They don't actually pray, or at least very few of them pray. They don't fast. They have very few obligations. They believe in mystical communion with God. They don't believe in formal prayer. But you will see dozens and dozens of men in baggy trousers and in black clothes, sometimes in brown clothes, according to their rank in the clergy. And these are the Druze sheikhs, who are the initiates into the religion. Because one of the most startling things about the Middle Eastern faiths that are in this book is that they are very secretive about what they believe. Far from being told to believe something and that's your faith and you must preach it and believe it, on the contrary, if you're a Druze or a Yazidi or a Mandaean, you probably don't know what the faith teaches. Your obligation is quite simply to belong to the community and support the religious elders. And they alone, after tough initiation rituals, are allowed to know the truths of the faith. And that's true of the Druze, among whom there are three or four particularly high clergymen who have access to even higher secrets than the others. So there's a tremendous hierarchy there. When the British went out there in 1860s, they assumed that the Druze were somehow connected to the Freemasons, and that they spent decades trying to sort of research this and work out exactly how the Freemasons and the Druze were connected. There being, in fact, no connection at all. But it's just an interesting insight into how.
But do you think Lebanon, when we see a country like that today, even though there are, you know, there are many pressures on that country following events in Syria and before, obviously, with the civil war, but even somehow today that offers the kind of patchwork that you're now seeing eroded elsewhere?
Completely. And in Lebanon, it survived for some specific reasons, kind of in a way that there is no single religion there that can dominate all the others. And therefore, they have to, having had a terrible civil war in which, you know, one in 20 people died, they now have realize that they just have to come to terms with each other. And interestingly, Lebanon, according to polling by Gallup, is one of the places in the world where people are most likely to accept somebody of a different religion living next door to them. So they have really, you know, learned, I think, a lesson from the terrible events of their past. And that gives us a bit of hope that perhaps other parts of the Middle East can likewise move away from religious conflict and towards a kind of tolerance.
Let me ask you to pick up on what you're saying before about secrecy when talking about the Druze. And it's interesting that there are a lot of misunderstandings. We mentioned the sort of recent persecution of the Yazidis, and they were sort of characterised in some quarters as sort of, you know, devil worshippers. There's a very profound misunderstanding about what their culture and what their religion represented. Do you think that secrecy, there is again that secrecy, is that because of that secrecy? Or do you think it's simply that these people have not been compelled to engage with people from, you know, beyond these relatively narrow borders?
The Yazidis do have interesting beliefs that are quite challenging for those who are unfamiliar with them. They believe in an unknowable God. This is a very familiar thing from Greek philosophy and the ancient Middle East. And that between that God and mankind, there are intermediaries, one of which is the peacock angel, Malak Ta'us, who is, in the form of a peacock, is revered, and Yazidis will kiss the image of the bird at ceremonies. This angel, as they see it, is the fallen angel, whom we call Lucifer, but in their tradition, repented and was forgiven by God and restored to favour. And what they mean by that is that hell has been abolished. Malak Ta'us's tears of repentance extinguished the fires of hell. That actually is a mystical belief that some Christians and Muslims have had in the past, but the Yazidis have really taken it and made it a central tenet of their beliefs that there is no such thing anymore as the devil or hell.
When you look at the example of the Copts in Egypt, whose communities have suffered bombings and their churches being destroyed, and who throughout the region have suffered, and many of those people are going into exile, they're coming here to Europe. There is a thriving Coptic community here in London. Do you feel that or fear that that's the future for many of these communities? They are going to be religions in exile.
I do, and if you go to Detroit in the United States, you can really see hundreds of thousands of Middle Eastern emigres from different religious communities, most of them Christian, who have upped and gone from Iraq, Egypt, and elsewhere. I think that the biggest losers of all this are the Muslims of the Middle East, who I think have benefited greatly from having religious diversity in the past. From the very start of their civilization in the 7th century right up to the present day, the presence of these other faiths among them has been a great spur to excellence. And they will, sadly, I think, have a less interesting culture as a result of this ending of religious diversity.
Gerard Russell, thanks very much for coming to tell us all about your book. Fascinating insights. It's called Heirs to Forgotten Kingdoms, Journeys into the Disappearing Religions of the Middle East. And yeah, thanks for coming to tell us all about it.
Thank you.
That is just about all we have time for on edition 290 of the Monocle Weekly. What a programme, Andrew. We really got stuck into some meaty old topics this week, didn't we?
Yes, Daniel Capelli. He had some light moments at the top of the show.
He's very interested in various forms of war, death, destruction, incarceration.
No, so there's lots of interesting things. Intriguing, I met Jamie Byng many, many years ago when I worked for another media organisation. When he was first starting out, Canongate, which is his publishing house he's got. It's amazing to see, you know, we're always here talking about the book and how the book survives. And here we've had a series of people coming in today with, you know, thunderous books to drop on table. And you realise, you know, that all the debate about, you know, e-books, it doesn't matter, it's the tale you tell. And here's this book that, you know, has resonated with people around the world and will continue to do so. It was really interesting to see a publisher and an editor and a writer and what that kind of holy union can do to kind of change how we think about things.
Well, I still think there's something about, you know, the printed page, the power, isn't, you know, Jamie was talking about when he first saw these, you know, handwritten notes that was written on. And even we talked about Charlie Hebdo, but going back to that, things seem to still matter more when they're consigned to paper. Whatever the, you know, the access that digital age permits, that has a resonance that, well, it doesn't seem to lose its emotional impact.
No, so a bit of a tough show, but we, you know, I think we've covered some big topics.
Very interesting indeed, yeah.
Should we go and have some Yorkshire puddings now?
I think exactly. A lavish lunch is the only thing we need now. Andrew, I think you'll be back possibly with Robert Bound in his regular chair next week.
Yeah, he slipped away to the beach this week. I don't know why he's doing that, but anyway.
I'd say it's a bit brisk for that kind of thing, but there you go. you and he will be back next week, so make
Shriveled,
sure...
Shriveled, I think is the word.
Please, let's not go there. Andrew and Rob will be back next week, so join them for that. But for this week's edition of the show, from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
That is all we have time for. Goodbye.